Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. This little note at the beginning of the program. Today we'll remember writer Winston Groom, who died in 2020. We're revisiting our conversation with him from November of 2015. In this interview, we talk about his most famous book, Forrest Gump, as well as his then most recent book, The Generals. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In his new book, The Generals, historian Winston Groom tells the intertwined and uniquely American tales of George Patton, Douglas MacArthur, and George Marshall, from the World War I battle that shaped them to their greatest victory, leading the Allies to victory in World War II. These three remarkable men of arms who rose from the gruesome hell of the First World War to become the finest generals of their generation during World War II redefined America's ideas of military leadership, brought forth a new generation of American soldier. Their efforts revealed to the world the grit and determination that would become synonymous with America in the post-war years. My guest for the hour today is Winston Groom. He's author of several previous books, including Forrest Gump, The Aviators, Conversations with the Enemy. That one was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. 1942, The Year That Tried Men's Souls, Vicksburg, 1863, and Shiloh, 1862. He served in Vietnam as an officer with the 4th Infantry Division. He lives in Point Clear, Alabama. And we reach him by telephone. Winston Groom, a pleasure to welcome you to Access Utah. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So we're coming up on Veterans Day. Your book is released, I believe, today by National Geographic. I wonder what, do you have any Veterans Day rituals that you do or memories?
I don't know. I'm in New York City right now. I'm looking out on Fifth Avenue, and the radio just said you think it's going to rain on Veterans Day.
Okay. All right. So there'll be parades and such, but I guess soldiers can soldier through the rain.
That's right.
So you grew up in Alabama. I think you still live there.
I did. I was raised in Mobile, Alabama, which is on the coast, and I live across the bay from Mobile in Mobile Bay. I lived in New York for 10 years, lived in Washington for 10 years, so I've sort of been around, but I call Alabama home.
And you went to military school, I believe.
I did. It was a boys' military school. Okay. I went to college at the University of Alabama, but I grew up in a boys' military school, which is, you know, that's not military anymore. It's not just boys, but it's been around for 100-something years, and it's still going strong.
And then in the Vietnam War, were you in Vietnam?
I was. Mm-hmm. I was. I'd gone into ROTC at college, and there wasn't any war. But by the time I graduated, there was, and most of us in that class went over there.
Mm-hmm. And you wrote a novel about the war, Better Times Than These.
I did, Better Times Than These. That was my first book.
Well received, I think.
It was. It was.
By the way, looping.
Put me on the course of being a writer, novelist.
Right. In fact, you worked for a newspaper, and I believe you said, "I'm quitting. I'm going to do this."
Yeah. Well.
Burned your bridges.
I couldn't very well. I think if you'd, you know, failed at it, you wouldn't want to go back. And I sort of noticed that if you looked into the drawers of a lot of desks of those. Some of those older journalists, you would find three things. You'd find a pack of Lucky Strikes or something similar, or you'd find a bottle of Seagram's VO, and you'd find an unfinished novel manuscript.
Yeah,
I think I'm going to just do this. And Washington, it was not the town to, I think, write novels. It's a political town. Mm. And so I just said, I'm going to change my whole game here, and I moved to New York, and sat down and wrote the book, and there I go.
And I'm not sure in what sequence, and then comes Forrest Gump. Where'd that idea come from?
That was another 4 or 5 books later, I guess. I tell you where ideas come from, because it's not like, oh, here's a fellow I know, he's Forrest Gump. But I was going back from New York in the wintertime home to visit my father, who was getting quite old then. He was born in 1906, and he was telling one day at lunch a reminiscence about a young boy in his neighborhood who was what they then called retarded, and the other kids would tease him and chase him and throw sticks at him and so on. And at some point, this young boy's mother bought a piano. And within a few days, this gorgeous piano music came wafting out of this house. And the other kids thought that was neat, and so they took him under their wing. And I went back to that evening, and I thought, you know, I'm going to make some notes about that story, because I remember that CBS 60 Minutes had just done a thing on the idiot-savant syndrome, where you have a person who basically can't tie their own shoes, but they can do complex mathematical and musical things. And so I was going to use it as a scene, maybe in some book later, and by late that night, I had finished the first chapter of Forrest Gump.
And
that's the way these things happen.
And I guess you couldn't have known what a hit it would be. And it's still, in fact, today I was just tooling around the internet, found this from Huffington Post. It's lessons we can learn from Forrest Gump on death and dying. That's just from yesterday. It's become a touchstone, an icon.
It's pretty iconic. It's interesting. No, of course you couldn't. No, I didn't. When I finished the book, I thought maybe I was crazy. I didn't even show it to my literary agent. I called up a friend, Willie Morris, who was a very fine editor and writer. He was at that point the writer in residence at the University of Mississippi, and I asked him if he'd read it, and he said, certainly. And so about 2 weeks later, I got a phone call at about 2 o'clock in the morning, which is Willie's chosen time to talk usually. And all he said was, don't change a word.
Did you,
there it went.
Did you set out to have Forrest, and the name has become a touchstone. The Forrest Gump of this or that, meaning someone who's ubiquitous throughout periods in history. Did you set out to try to do a sweep of history with this character?
I didn't know what I was going to do, and that's the truth. I didn't have a net, so to speak. I didn't have an outline. I didn't have notes. I didn't have research. I just sat down and said, well, what's going to happen today? It was completely unplowed ground as far as I was concerned, and so, I mean, I didn't know. I just would let my mind say what he's going to do. I think it came from what I call my lizard brain. We all have a lizard brain in the back of our neck. And it went right through the regular brain, under the 10 fingers, under the, you know, the machine. And out it came, and I'd look at it, and I'd say, well, that's not bad. I don't think I was never really sure about it until Willie said that, and then I gave it to my agent, and he loved it, and the movies bought it, and that was it. And that's history.
What'd you think of the job Robert Zemeckis and Tom Hanks did in the film?
Oh, God, it's a billion-dollar show. You can't complain about that.
That's right. Academy Awards and everything, yeah.
Yeah.
I saw another interview. This is very interesting to me. You talk with Gregory Peck, who I guess knows his way around Alabama. And he said to you, speaking about Forrest Gump, he says, we don't have heroes anymore. We have anti-heroes. And he pointed out Forrest Gump as I guess, a hero.
Well, I'll tell you what he said. I have a little newspaper clipping in this little case I got in front of me on the desk. And he says, they asked him, how are today's leading men different from those of an earlier age? And Gregory Peck says, nowadays our heroes on the screen are not strong, steadfast, courageous, and reliable. They're morally ambivalent, said Peck. The only hero we've had on the screen lately who represented all those virtues is Forrest Gump, and he was a little bit retarded.
Yeah.
Maybe that's more true to life.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like a part of the response to Forrest Gump is the fact that he's retarded, or you know, he's an innocent, at the very least.
Yeah, well, that's what I wanted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Somebody to sort of bounce things off of.
Yeah.
In a world seen through the eyes of somebody who is looking at things from about 15 degrees off.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any pressure from your publisher for Forrest Gump 2 or for another novel? Or
I didn't get a lot of pressure, but they asked me if I was interested in doing one, and I did one. Mm-hmm. It's called Gump and Company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it came out and sold a lot of books. It's more about Little Forrest than it is Forrest Gump.
Right, right. Once you get a good character, you want to explore it. You've said another place as well that novelists have one, maybe two, maybe three good novels. Is that why you went on to nonfiction?
Yeah, and of course there are exceptions to that. Of course, Dickens comes to mind, and other people. But I just what happens, I think, at least in my experience, is looking at friends of mine who write, and you're lucky if you have one good book, and you're extremely fortunate to have two or three. But if you don't know what else to do, you keep on writing fiction, and then the critics get after you, and then you get down on yourself, and you some of them wind up like Fitzgerald and Thomas Wolfe drinking himself to death, or Hemingway blew his brains out, and that was not exactly a path that I wanted to go down.
No.
And I thought, well, the problem with novels is the idea part of it. Writing it is not that hard, but if you don't have a really good idea, but you still got to write, that's a recipe, I think, for trouble. And I thought, well, you start with a novel, you start with a blank piece of paper. But with history, you've got a beginning, middle, and end, and it's just a question of putting it all together right. And I'd always wanted to do a history, and I talked to one of my publishers about it, and he said, sure. So I did, and that was The Shrouds of Glory, and that it did well. And so I was on that path, and I've liked it. I mean, I enjoy every minute of it. It beats work.
Yeah, that's true. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get into talking about The Generals, and we're talking specifically in Winston Groom's new book about George Patton, Douglas MacArthur, and George Marshall. And they shared a World War I battle. In fact, MacArthur and Patton were dodging fire as they conversed during one World War I battle. Parallel lives intertwined a lot, and of course, they were prominent in World War II. Talk about it following the break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're remembering historian and writer Winston Groom. He died in 2020. We had the good fortune to talk to him in November of 2015. That's when this conversation that you're hearing is first broadcast. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're very pleased to have historian Winston Groom with us. His new book is The Generals, and tells the intertwined and uniquely American tales of George Patton, Douglas MacArthur, and George Marshall. Winston Groom is author previously of Forrest Gump, The Aviators, 1942, The Year That Tried Men's Souls, Vicksburg, 1863, Shiloh, 1862. And he joins me from New York City. So Winston Groom, why these three men?
Well, I had, when I wrote The Aviators, that was, of course, Charles Lindbergh and Eddie Rickenbacker and Jimmy Doolittle, who were the most prominent aviators of the 20th century. I thought I was onto something. That book was pretty successful, and so I was casting around for what to do next, and thought, I'd love to do something on Patton, and I'd love to do something on MacArthur. I didn't want to do necessarily a full biography with, you have to explore all the orifices. And I thought Eisenhower, and I thought, I need three people, but I love MacArthur in the Pacific and Patton in Europe, and George Marshall in between, trying to keep both of them from imploding. They were both very difficult guys, and probably a lesser chief of staff would have fired them. But Marshall was smart enough to realize that they were winners, and he wanted to keep them in the war, and it was a good thing.
And I think what we have little snippets. Once you become an icon, they're sort of these stereotypes. So with MacArthur, I shall return. The fact that he was fired by Truman, Patton slapped the soldier, you know, for example. We have these little tidbits. The men, of course, are fuller than that. Marshall, I don't know if we, in popular conception, if we even think about George Marshall.
No, he's sort of faded, but in his time, he was probably the best-known soldier in the American Army. He was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and of course he was present as well in Washington. The Washington Press Corps was there, but then he became Secretary of State, and then he became the Secretary of Defense. And he was, of course, the Marshall Plan in Europe was his baby, and he was quite well known in his day. But he's, because he wasn't a fighting soldier, his memory has faded somewhat.
These
he's a heck of an administrator.
These staff generals are, you know, invaluable, right? And that's in Patton or Marshall epitomizes this.
Well, yeah, I mean, the war is all planning, especially these days. I mean, it's not that, you know, you don't just go out with an army and fight somebody. It's a huge logistics and getting the right people in the right place and getting the right people to start with and knowing the right people, being able to pass on all these things. And my gosh, in World War II, that was an awfully demanding job with two huge battle fronts going on at the same time in North Africa and Pacific and Pacific and Europe. That was a brain and back-breaking job.
You write in your preface, I'll just read this paragraph, as we'll see in the following pages, you write, peacetime is not always kind to generals. They do not necessarily do well outside their task of generaling. And here's the key sentence. Perhaps that's because during war, they become as close to gods on earth as we are ever likely to see. Gods on earth, why do you use that phrase?
In their time, these men were. I mean, we were at war, and that was a serious thing in this country, because we've been at war now for 20 years. Nobody really cares much about it. There's little brush fire wars that Orwell talked about, but we were in true danger in World War II. We could have lost that war in 1942. And the press makes the generals into the gods. If you read the old press clippings and the newsreels, they were close to propaganda. And they portrayed these generals as much larger than life. I don't like that expression, but they were really worshipped. I mean, you remember they came back when MacArthur came back. He was given an enormous ticker tape parade in South Manhattan, and Patton the same. And they when they spoke, they would get 200,000 or 300,000 people there. They were very, very nearly worshipped as great heroes.
And in our times, where I think it's more cynical times, you maybe don't get as much of that.
Well, I'm afraid you're probably right, and I sure don't want a World War III to try to prove it.
Right, you're right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I don't think we have generals. I mean, what's his name? It was Schwarzkopf. He was very, very popular, but I don't believe that he was received the same kind of awe as a MacArthur or a Patton or even a George Marshall at what he did. But, you know, the wars are different these days. Thank God.
Yeah. Now, General, at least MacArthur, I believe, was quite good at his own press, quite good at his own PR. He had a flair for the dramatic and
Well, he not only had that, but he took the press that they sent over there and practically including them in his army. I mean, he gave them everything, and he expected them to toe the party line, and they did. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know. But the way that the military worked in those times, because secrecy was very, very important. And so the reporters were assigned to a particular army, and when they got to the army, the army assigned them, or somebody, the press division of the army would assign them to particular units wherever they wanted to go, if it was possible. But, you know, now they don't do that, although I think they did embed some reporters in one of those Gulf Wars. But, you know, if you would cover the military today or any time, the way a newspaper normally functions, I think that you would have an enormous conflict, because there are things that the military wishes to keep secret, and all those same things are the things the press wishes to let the public know. And I think the situation would be unworkable.
And in fact, embedded has become a phrase that is used pejoratively in some cases nowadays.
Yeah. I'm not really familiar with the inner workings of the modern army. I mean, I know, you know, a little bit something about it, but I think it's all about control. It's about trying to control the flow of information.
I'd like to go back, have you treat each of these men briefly, their background. You point out in the book, these are 19th century men. They were born, you know, and lived quite a long time in the 19th century. So maybe George Marshall first. Interestingly, I learned from this book, his father made a fortune, lost a fortune. He went, I believe, to VMI, Virginia Military Institute.
Yeah, he did. I think, really, if you look at Marshall, he spent, I don't know if he consciously did it, but he seemed to be trying to atone for his father's failure somehow by being the most competent person in every one of his endeavors. And he was, in fact, you know, the top of his class and so on. And he's very, very competent. He always wanted to be a fighting soldier, and they never would let him because he was so good at organizing.
In fact, there's a...
And MacArthur, of course, he, it's hard to believe that, but he grew up on these far-out western military posts where they were still fighting Indians. And he distinctly remembers flaming arrows coming up with the walls of the fort. His father was a great general, as a Medal of Honor winner in the First War. I mean, in the Civil War, MacArthur's father, and later went on to become a top general in the Army.
That's got to be hard to live up to. Was that part of his ambition, a Medal of Honor recipient for a father?
I believe so. Nobody ever said it of him, and nobody ever. He never said it of himself. But he, of course, won the Medal of Honor. He was given the Medal of Honor under difficult circumstances, because he was ordered by President Roosevelt to leave his army in the Philippines and go to Australia and take over the command of the entire Southwest Pacific. But the fear was that people would accuse him of deserting the sinking ship, because everybody knew that army was doomed. And so the president got the bright idea to give him the Medal of Honor for his activities in the Philippines, to sort of allay that thought that he might have been, you know, leaving the troops in some act of cowardice or something. Mm-hmm.
And I believe he still received some criticism for.
They all received criticism, and I include it in the story. But when you look at it as a whole, it was a brilliant idea to leave MacArthur there. He was highly competent to do what he did. I don't know if there was another general who could have done that, even though his behavior was sometimes bizarre and certainly was toward Washington was almost insubordinate. But I think he sensed that the people in Washington were not giving him the tools to do his job, and he was, in fact, correct. What he didn't know was that President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill had agreed to what they call the Germany First policy in that war, meaning they were going to send whatever they needed to do the tools that they needed to beat the Germans in Europe, and the Pacific was going to have to take the hindmost, whatever was left. And it infuriated MacArthur because he wasn't privy to that. They wouldn't even tell him about that policy, which he would not have liked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot of politics there. I wonder, you've been quoted elsewhere as saying that the man from this book that you'd most like to sit down and have a beer with, if you could, was Patton.
Well, he's an interesting guy. I mean, he was half crazy, I think. You know, he was dyslexic, and he learned to overcome it, by memorizing. He would memorize all of the math problems and essays and whatever he had to do. The only way he knew how to do it was by simply repeating what he could see. His reasoning powers weren't that good, but he was very funny about it, too. He said one time he was giving a speech to his troops, and it was sort of well known that his spelling was bad, and sometimes his grammar was bad. But he said, well, you know, he said, anybody can spell a word the same way every time. He said, it takes imagination to, like me, I spell it 4 or 5 different ways.
So tell me a little bit about his background.
Well, he was the richest man in the Army to begin with. And he was extremely driven. I'm not sure what drove him. His father went to VMI, and his grandfather had been a Confederate general who was killed. But from the time he was a small boy, he wanted to be a general in the Army. It's all he wanted. And it was very difficult for him to get the appointment, but he managed to get it. He went to VMI for a year as a sort of a prep school for West Point. And he got to West Point. He strived very well and competed very well. He, in fact, after he graduated, he was in the Olympics. They had in 1912 Olympics. They instituted a new sport called the pentathlon. I can't remember, but whatever it was the ancient Greeks used it, and it was a military game almost, in which in the Greek version that these soldiers would fight it out and kill each other. But they didn't do that in the modern Olympics. It was designed to see how well a courier would do if he had to ride and shoot and swim and sword fight and run. And so I think there were 40 participants in this. It was held in Stockholm, and Patton came out number 8 out of all of those things. But he had learned all these things. He learned to fencing at West Point, and he learned to swim because his family owned Catalina Island, among other things, and he'd swim around the island. And he was an excellent rider. He was the captain of the Army's polo team, and in West Point he had also run track, so he was pretty fit for all that. He was beaten out by a Swede, I believe, who became his best friend.
I think
he was an interesting guy.
Yeah, I think one thing that I think some people at least know about him, and you treat this a bit in the book, Patton believed in reincarnation.
Yeah, he did. He did. He was pretty convincing about it too. Traveling around Europe, he would sniff out these various sites of old ancient battlefields of the Romans, he would tell his wife that he'd been there, he had fought there. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But he certainly believed it.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't seem to press it on people. I mean, you know, sometimes people look at you like you're a nut, say things like that. He just casually say it and move on to something else.
Now, you said earlier, and I think this is part of the our sort of stereotype of Patton, a little bit crazy?
Well, it has been explained in other books on him, observations, that this dyslexia produces a different kind of personality, sort of aggressive, defensive, that sort of thing. And he was certainly aggressive. He could be defensive. He could be outrageous. But he was basically a gentleman and was raised as such. And, you know, he would show up at these Army posts in the 1920s and 30s, as a lieutenant with a yacht and a string of polo ponies, and you would think that people would have been jealous of him for that, but they weren't. They got to know him because he was an excellent rider and he was an excellent yachtsman. And he could back all that stuff up. He was one of those guys that I found him sort of the most interesting. Although I'm sure MacArthur, they said he could speak eloquently on any subject on earth, and I may have a beer with Patton and a glass of wine with MacArthur. Maybe I should have written that.
Yeah, you're right. All right, the both of them. Patton, I've heard the criticism of Patton. Maybe have you respond to this, having studied him, that he was a little too loose with these men and men's lives. In other words, too willing to burn through lives. This is a criticism I think some generals get. What do you think about it with Patton?
Well, when you look at the serious generals we've had, and we haven't had that many. I mean, you have to look back to the Civil War. You have to look back to, say, the Spanish-American War, Roosevelt and his Rough Riders going up San Juan Hill, General Grant, and they called Grant a butcher. But their theory, and I think Sherman expressed it as well, is that the quicker we can get this thing over with, the more lives we're going to save. And if we have to expend lives now, it will save a lot of lives in the future. If the war continues for another year, 2 years, you're going to have a lot of people killed. That was the rationale. The point was to win it, not to save lives. I mean, obviously, you want to save lives, and you don't want to do these crazy frontal assaults anymore against automatic weapons and that kind of stuff. What you want to do is use the kind of tactics that you're going to win it. You know lives are going to be lost if you're a general. I mean, hell, you know lives are going to be lost if you're a lieutenant. But the general has a lot more responsibility. But I think the theory that they put into practice was the same theory that Grant used, which was, it's going to be rough, but this is the best, quickest way to end it.
Let's take another break when we come back.
And I think that war in Europe, I must say, would probably have gone on another year, adolescent man, than Patton been with the Third Army.
Oh, really?
It could well have.
Why so? What did he do?
Well,
right,
I think Patton just drove his people. I mean, the other generals, Montgomery was was sitting up there in the north doing practically nothing, and at the same time, Patton was being held back. He was the one responsible for breaking out of Normandy, and he reached the Seine, and then he reached the Rhine, and they had to stop him. Basically, politics.
Mm-hmm. He was
British wanted to be in on it.
He was a fervent anti-communist, right? And famously, he was chomping the bit. He thought, well, we're going to have to fight the Soviets sooner or later.
Well, he was certainly prescient about it. I don't know what would have happened, but he said to people that he certainly had the army that could do it right then. Mm. He said, I'll be in Moscow in a week if you want me to.
Right.
I don't know whether he could have or not, but certainly the Russians carved up their, all of Eastern Europe and as much of Western Europe as they could, and that's what Patton had predicted they were going to do.
Yeah, and who knows what would have happened, but he certainly was prescient in that that respect. Let's take another break. When we come back, I want to go back to World War One. These three generals, not generals at the time, were involved in a specific battle, and World War One certainly had an effect on the three who would become famous and critical to success in World War Two. More with Winston Groom. His book is The Generals. It's being released today by National Geographic. More following the break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're remembering Winston Groom. He died in 2020. This conversation that you're hearing was first broadcast in November of 2015. Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In his new book, The Generals, historian Winston Groom tells the intertwined and uniquely American tales of George Patton, Douglas MacArthur, and George Marshall, from the World War I battle that shaped them to their greatest victory, leading the Allies to victory in World War II. Winston Groom is author of several books, including Forrest Gump, The Aviators, and 1942, The Year That Tried Men's Souls. He was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize for Conversations with the Enemy. You're welcome to join the conversation here if you would like. Our email is upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com, and we're on Twitter at Utah Public Radio. So, Winston Groom, for several chapters, describe these three gentlemen's adventures, you could call it that, or experiences in World War One. In fact, there's a couple of scenes in the book where Patton and MacArthur, under fire, are conversing. They actually met each other on the battlefield.
They did. this was the Battle of the Meuse Argonne, which was, it still is, the most costly single battle, I think, that this country's ever fought. We had 26,000 men killed in it. And it was the final push against the Germans and eastern France and northeastern France. And Patton had become involved in tanks. This was, of course, a new weapon. And he was, in fact, the commander of the American Tank Corps. He was a colonel. MacArthur, at that point, was a general. And they made a push, and at some point there on the battlefield, MacArthur found himself with Patton standing there in a conversation. All the men around him were lying down in the foxholes or whatever protection they could find. And there was a rolling barrage coming toward them. They could see it. And they stood there and continued their conversation. As Patton put it later to his wife, he thought that both of them wanted to get down, but neither one of them wanted to be the first one to do it.
There is a sense of bravado, isn't there? Generals, of course, in ancient times, and in the preface, you start your book with Alexander the Great. Generals, of course, would be at the front fighting with their men, but as it became so complex, then generals are more to the rear, but these two men, MacArthur and Patton, certainly wanted to show bravado.
Well, Patton in particular, I mean, MacArthur, it's hard to figure him out, but he seemed to be completely oblivious to enemy fire. Patton, on the other hand, was scared that he was going to become a coward, and he kept trying to prove himself, which is sometimes when I was going through the research material, I would say, well, why would somebody do that? That's nuts. But he did because he wanted to prove himself, and probably MacArthur did too, but he just for some reason seemed very casual about it. Hmm. And it's interesting how people react in those circumstances.
I wonder if we could return to George Marshall, and he kind of gets lost in the shuffle sometimes because he wasn't on the battlefield. He wanted to, of course, but he was just so valuable. Roosevelt, what did he say? He was worth a division, or you know, he was invaluable to Roosevelt. Tell me a little bit more about George Marshall.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Tell me a little more about George Marshall.
Well, he could have become the commander of the invasion of Europe, the job that he gave Eisenhower. He very much wanted to. That would have at last given him the opportunity to command troops in battle, large troops. And Roosevelt asked him. He didn't order him not to. He simply asked him. He said, I'd rather have you here, but essentially the decision is up to you. And he was a pretty selfless guy, Marshall, and he gave up that last great opportunity. He had a temper, and he could certainly be forceful, but he was essentially a sort of a nice guy, and that's the way he got along with people. It's also the way, I believe, after the war, when I mentioned that some soldiers don't do well, professional military people, after the war, he did not do particularly well. I think part of his problem was when he was Secretary of, they sent him to China to try to straighten out the conflicts between Mao Zedong and Chiang Kai-shek, Mao Zedong being the communist. And he'd been used to dealing with the Russians, and he knew they were difficult to deal with, but they were friends. And he thought that the Chinese communists were going to be his friends. And in fact, they were not his friend at all. And So the result was he accomplished nothing. And the same thing happened when he was the Secretary of State. He seemed to think he could deal with the Russians, and it was his belief that, you know, he was going to put the soldier part aside, and we're going to be a compromise part, that a Secretary of State who should always be for peace. And so he really did not do well in his negotiating with the Soviet communists, nor the Chinese communists, nor any communists for that matter. So in that way, I think he was a little off balance when he put down his soldier hat and put on the other hat.
Now, you said before, I wonder if you could expand on this, that part of his headache was dealing with generals like MacArthur and Patton.
Sure it was.
He did it very well.
Yeah, I mean, he recognized that they were, I was going to say indispensable, but nobody's indispensable. But MacArthur gave him headaches. He would read statements that MacArthur made about that gang in Washington, of course, meant him. Was not providing the materials. And, you know, it was true. Some of these guys, I mean, it was very difficult out there. The airplanes, the parts wouldn't show up, and the planes wouldn't show up, and they couldn't get the proper shipping, and they couldn't get the ammunition. And that's all very frustrating for a commander when he's got a job to do and he's trying to do it. Probably anyone but MacArthur would not have survived those remarks that were printed in the press about the gang in Washington. But the Marshall didn't have anybody to replace him with.
Yeah.
And the same is true with Patton. I mean, Patton was a leader. He was a fighter. He won every battle he was in, and it would be very difficult to replace him. Eisenhower wanted to replace him, in fact. And Eisenhower consulted Marshall. That was after the slapping incident, and Marshall said no.
Mm-hmm. By the way, what do you make of the slapping incident? It's one of the bullet points when you, you know, when you think about Patton.
Yeah, I think that, and a lot of it has to do with that movie, because you know, very few people now remember lived in those days, and. But it was reported, in the newspapers, and it was an act of incredible impetuosity and stupidity. But Patton did not believe in what they then called combat fatigue. I think now it's something disorder. I don't know. But whatever it was, he went to a military hospital, and there were soldiers all shot up and. Every different way, and then there's one soldier who's sitting down on the bed, and Patton asked him what was wrong with him, and he said he can't take it anymore. And Patton just went crazy, and he started bawling him out, and at some point he slapped him. And he said later that he was trying to restore his manhood, but unfortunately for Patton, after the incident, some of the doctors got reported this, and actually Eisenhower sat on it. And then I think Drew Pearson got wind of it and reported it in the press, and all the other press started doing it. It was a big, huge outcry, hue and cry about it, and that's really what got Eisenhower angry. But in any case, they did nothing about it.
And, you know, you bring up the movie. That sometimes happens, doesn't it? If we didn't live through the history, we maybe haven't read about it, we'd think of George C. Scott and Gregory Peck. That's what we think about.
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. As I went along in the research, I got to look at the photographs of actual photographs of Patton MacArthur and Marshall, you know, so often that I quit doing that. But that was my first visual image of them was from the movies, and the movies were remarkably accurate. I didn't see any sort of storytelling or launching off into anything, either one of those. They followed pretty much the facts as I found them.
Just have about a minute left, and we've talked about a bit about Marshall's post-war years, had some difficulties the generals sometimes run into. Patton died very soon after the war, I think, right? And he's in a car accident, or aftermath of a car accident. He's buried in Luxembourg. What about MacArthur? He came home, made famous speech.
He had a long career, very, very successfully rehabilitated Japan for 4 or 5 years after the war, and he changed it. This was a very difficult thing to do because their culture was such, you know, they were led by an emperor and there was no democracy and women were treated poorly and so on. He reversed all of that and gave them a democracy and put them back on the path to being a highly industrialized, welcome member of Western civilization or Eastern civilization. And he had about accomplished his task when the Korean War broke out. The North Koreans attacked South Korea, the communists, and we had agreed to protect South Korea. And he, at this point, had very little army left, but he took what he had up there and managed to stop the hemorrhaging and then pulled off a brilliant landing at the port of Incheon, which is near Seoul, and not only stopped the hemorrhaging, but he chased the North Koreans back up beyond the 38th parallel. And he had a problem with President Truman, who was trying to negotiate the war to some conclusion. And MacArthur put out a public statement to the North, the Chinese communists who had joined in with the North Koreans that they needed to surrender him immediately or they would be destroyed. And that didn't do well for President Truman, so he fired General MacArthur, who then came to New York City and lived in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel for the rest of his life.
He had a real flair for speaking, and the famous speech, "Old soldiers never die." You know, that's just one of many examples from MacArthur.
Yeah, when he came back here, it was not under a cloud of being fired. It was a great hero because President Truman was not particularly popular, and MacArthur was asked to address both houses of Congress, which he did, a joint session, and made such an emotionally stirring speech that the Speaker of the House was heard to quip that there was not a dry eye on the Democrat side or a dry seat on the Republican side. He then went on to make his famous West Point speech. That was shortly before his death. And he was a terrific orator.
What do you make now, having spent time with these three? Were there any surprises? What do you come away with?
Not really surprises. It just the richness of their lives, I think, impressed me, and things that I didn't know. When I do these books, I sort of deliberately choose a subject that I'm not particularly familiar with. Not intimately familiar with in any case. I think it brings something to the writing because I get excited about learning new things about the subject, and I think I can then convey that excitement to the reader. But I don't know, these guys were amazing men. I mean, their lives were surrounded with patriotism and courage and character, and I think that they were true real American heroes.
What's next for you?
Next, would you believe the admirals?
The admirals, okay. Who? Yeah. Which ones?
Well, I'm not going to take the ones that everybody's done, like Admiral King, who's the chief of naval operations, Admiral Nimitz. I was going to do the fighting admirals, and that would be Halsey and Raymond Spruance, who at the Battle of Midway, and a guy nobody's heard, very few people heard of, Clifton Sprague. They had at the Battle of Leyte Gulf, the Halsey had gone off chasing some Japanese, he was decoyed off chasing Japanese carriers, and the entire Japanese surface fleet, including these enormous battleships that they had built, suddenly appeared. And Leyte is in the Philippines, it's an island. And MacArthur had just landed, and they were headed straight for the fleet. All the transport ships, and then bombard the beaches, and would probably have destroyed the invasion. And Admiral Sprague, with his little band of escort carriers, successfully beat these people back and sent them back to Japan. Mm. And that was, I mean, it was like a high school football team playing the Dallas Cowboys.
Sounds
that much difference. I mean, in the weight.
Yeah.
Of these three or four destroyers and destroyer escorts and little small escort carriers. But they somehow did it. I don't know to this day exactly how they did it.
Well, it sounds interesting. But Admirals will be coming up next from Winston Groom. The current book is The Generals. It's out from National Geographic. Winston Groom, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.